This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
Anyway, this is our first author talk of 2016, and we're especially delighted to start the year with a local writer and very familiar face, I'm sure, to many of you, David Gregory. David, of course, enjoyed quite an accomplished 20-year career with NBC News that included a time as the chief White House correspondent and then moderator for 6 years of Meet the Press. And it turns out that while he was pursuing his demanding career as a journalist, David also, about 10 years ago, set off on a private quest that involved his own faith as a Jew. The son of a Jewish father and a Catholic mother, David had grown up as more of a cultural Jew than an observant one. He married a Methodist, but wanting still to raise his kids as Jews, he was inspired, and with his wife Beth's support and encouragement, he was inspired to figure out what he really believed and to deepen his own faith. After parting ways with NBC nearly a year and a half ago, David decided to write a book, though it's not the one that many might have expected. The book, How's Your Faith, is less about his journalistic journey than his spiritual one, a journey that has driven him to examine basic questions about life and about man's relationship with God, and to seek answers in a variety of places, through formal Bible study, discussions with such religious figures as a Baptist pastor, a Presbyterian theologian, and the Archbishop of New York, and visits to megachurches and Orthodox synagogues. Carlos Lozada, writing in the Washington Post, called the work, quote, thoughtful, introspective, and moving, adding it's, quote, a book for seekers of faith, not fame. And Jeff Goldberg said in The Atlantic, quote, the book has been received well, in part because it is not what people might think it is. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Gregory.
Well, thank you all for. I'm really honored that you're all here. That you've come out on an actual winter night in Washington. This is rather intimidating. I want to make sure I'm looking around and I can see everybody and you can see me. This is genuinely intimidating for several reasons. One, this is my bookstore. I mean, this is absolutely my bookstore. I love it. I love, and the more, now having written a book, to understand the power or the importance of independent bookstores, I love it even more, what Bradley and team do here. Secondly, there are some people here who can genuinely embarrass me. A couple of ladies that I worked with at NBC, one of whom I worked for, who might have a few stories that are not in the book. And she was here before Angela's here. This is my kid's first librarian at their law school. There she is, Angela Smith. So, and others of you that I've seen around the community. So, thanks very much. I do want to say at the outset that, I mean, you know, we can certainly talk about God. I can talk about that a lot. But I'm also happy to talk about politics and things like that and media when you have some questions. I know. Well, that can be a bummer, but you know, if you're interested, I know, right? So, first of all, I do think it bears repeating that this is certainly not the book that anybody expected me to write. This is not a book about politics. It is not a book about my years in the media. I touch on what was a very difficult parting, a disappointing parting with NBC. But this is really something that's very personal and quite revealing, as my wife reminds me. My wife, who does not think it's a great idea to share a lot of your own personal story, found this to be a little bit uncomfortable. you know, I write about my family. I write about the secrets of my growing up. I write about personal pain. I write about, you know, the embarrassment of being, you know, scrutinized in Washington and losing a high profile job. But above all else, I write about this pursuit of something deeper, this pursuit of a deeper spiritual and religious life for myself. And so I begin with the title because that is, it's shocking enough, especially if you know the story of the title, How's Your Faith? It was President Bush who asked me the question. And he asked me because he knew that I had been studying going back when I was still covering the White House before Meet the Press. I had started to study with a Jewish educator, a woman named Erica Brown, who has a wonderful book out that I know is here called Take Your Soul to Work. And she's my teacher. She's been an educator in the area, and she's just fabulous. And so he'd known that I was studying with her and trying to deepen my faith. And I remember I got the job at Meet the Press, and I went to go see him. He had asked me this question on numerous occasions. As I said, he knew that I'd been studying. But on the one occasion that I write about, I had just gotten the job, and I went to go see him at the White House. The truth is, I was hoping he'd be my first guest on Meet the Press because, you know, he and I had this good relationship. And so I walk into the Oval Office, and he says, "There he is, girl. Stand up straight. Meet the Press." And so we sit down, we start talking. We're talking about the economy and all these various things and how I'll be scrutinized and what it'll be like to, you know, to succeed someone like Tim Russert and on and on. And then he said, "Gregory, how's your faith?" And again, not the first time he'd asked me the question, but even then I was so struck at how blunt the question is. I mean, to be asked that of anyone, let alone the President of the United States, is quite penetrating and quite piercing. And the reason why it's the title of the book is because I kept coming back to it as a question that invited something of me. It invited me to examine myself and to ask some really important questions beyond just this. How's my faith? Is it as strong as it used to be? Is it as strong as it was when I was young? Where and when do I feel my faith most strongly? Is it with my wife? Is it with my children? Is it out in nature? And more to the point, would it be different? Would my life be different? Would my life be better if my faith were stronger? And so the question sat with me. I was both very inspired by the question and his own journey. I mean, whatever you think about President Bush and his politics, the one thing I say in the book is that you can certainly agree on the fact that his faith remained intact when he left office. And the fact that he turned to faith as a way to personally transform himself in the middle of his life, struggling with alcohol, struggling with other difficulties in his life, that faith was something that helped him transform as a person, to grow as a person, to get better, to achieve a certain degree of self-mastery in his life. And it was something that I respected. I identified with that because I had grown up with an alcoholic mother. My mother was arrested in front of me when I was 15 years old for drunk driving, and I write about that in the book. And the reason I start with that in the book is that for me, this idea of a spiritual journey had to begin with understanding the dynamic of what I grew up with and my own family dynamic. What happened there? How do I understand it? How do I understand those years of feeling isolated and alone and angry and kind of abandoned in a way? My childhood was not a disaster by any means, but this was certainly a very difficult period in my adolescence to feel that and have nowhere to turn. I didn't have faith in God growing up. I was Jewish culturally, like a lot of Jews in America, but I didn't have particularly strong belief. And so when my mother was arrested and we're going through her alcoholism, there was nobody to tell me that things were going to be okay. Nobody to say, look, this is a rough deal, but, you know, it'll all be all right. Not God, not my father, who was divorced from my mother. No other adult in my life. And it was incredibly lonely and isolating. And so, in a way, I go back to an absence of faith to try to examine faith and to try to think about how to deepen it. And so the time spent with these questions about faith, about deepening faith, and about pursuing faith were ones that I kept coming back to. And the truth is, the reason why I began the pursuit to begin with was not, as it often happens, you know, it wasn't out of a sense of crisis. You know, a lot of people thought, oh, I know, he lost his job at Meet the Press and then he found God. I often say that would have been an easier hook, you know, to tell. But it really didn't go like that. I was actually in a different place. I mean, I was, you know, in my 30s. I was covering the White House. I was very successful. I had a wonderful wife and kids, and thinking, wow, I mean, what else is there? What do I do with this? How do I try to become a more grateful person? How do I try to grow? How do I understand how to live a life of meaning and purpose as a Jew, as a person of faith? And how do I find a way of explaining that or expressing that gratitude? In other words, I felt a kind of spiritual longing. You know, I write about this, and I think about the book as the intersection between identity and inspiration. You know, I wanted to understand what it meant for me to be Jewish. Me, David Gregory, whose father was Donald Ginsburg, but who changed his name because, like a lot of, you know, men and women at that time who wanted to become an actor, he changed his name from Ginsburg to Gregory, because apparently it's not so easy for Jews to make it in show business. And there was a time in America when that was actually not a laugh line. But so, you know, I grew up, my mother's not Jewish, Irish Catholic, so I've certainly had to self-identify a lot in my life, or else people would have no idea. As a matter of fact, when I speak in front of a Jewish audience, the first thing I say is, yes, I am. There's always the, you know, the laughter. Who knew? And he's so tall. But I wanted to go beyond. I wanted to go beyond this idea of identity. I wanted to really explore something more. So for me, faith. For me, a spiritual relationship with God, as I understand God, is about being inspired to try to be better, to try to deal with my weaknesses, to try to deal with my flaws, to try to be a better husband and a better father and a better human being. I can tell you, some people here can attest to the fact, that working in the wilds of television news is not exactly the best place for the spiritual journey to flourish. The whole construct, I can't look at you because you're going to laugh. The whole idea of working on trying to become more humble or less arrogant or less or more self-aware or perhaps more compassionate, again, the antithesis of a business that is designed around, especially when you're on television, to cater to your needs. I mean, I tell the story about when I was doing Meet the Press, I'd get there on Sunday morning, you know, at 7:30 in the morning, I'd be met by my executive producer, my assistant, my senior producer, my makeup artist, interns. I mean, there was nothing that was not catered to, that was not, so I mean, talk about it all being about me. This was not a great way to work on some of these areas of self-improvement. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. That was my own weakness. But it's certainly not a great environment to avoid gossiping about others and to be positive about others. It's just a rough, really rough business. So, you know, this idea of trying to become better, to try to elevate myself, is something that I found in faith and was inspired to go more deeply into faith. The idea of, yes, as faith and religion, as self-improvement, as a way of transforming yourself and as a way of bettering yourself, is something that I really came to identify with and want to know more about. So I've spent a lot of time asking questions in journalism, and yet what I write about in the book is that there were critical questions that were asked of me that really fueled this search. And so the question, how's your faith, was met by me initially as something of a blank page. As I say, I had an identity, a cultural identity as a Jew growing up in Los Angeles, but no real belief. Like a lot of Jews, I really didn't know a lot about theology or a lot about the Jewish faith, about what the religion teaches or what it teaches ethically, what the responsibilities were. I just knew that I was Jewish, and so it was just a sense of identity. And that, I think, as I got older and I was really examining it, left me feeling a bit bereft. My wife, who I write about, Beth Wilkinson, I met because she was one of the prosecutors who, in the Oklahoma City bombing cases. She was actually the woman who the prosecutor who made the argument to the jury that Timothy McVeigh should get the death penalty. And I write about meeting her, and she's a formidable person, as you might imagine. And, you know, when we got together initially and started thinking about having kids and all that, like a lot of couples were thinking, okay, well, how are we going to raise the kids? And it was so important to me that we be a Jewish family. It was honestly non-negotiable. I mean, it's not that I was a person of deep faith, but I had such a strong sense of identity. I couldn't have imagined our children not being Jewish. Beth grew up a Protestant in the Methodist Church in New England, felt very strongly about her own religious traditions, but acquiesced and said, okay, this is important to him. I'll still have my faith. It'll be okay. But she said to me, look, you know, I know what you are. I know who you are, but what is it that you believe? And that is a question that really inspired me to study, to really try to understand not just where I fit in the Jewish world, but what I really believed. What do I understand about the role that God plays in our lives? What do I know about the sacred Jewish texts or our sacred Christian texts as well? Now, what do I know about the Bible and the figures in the Bible and what they have to tell us about how to live our lives today? So it was an enormous challenge and one I met by beginning to study with a scholar, as I mentioned, my friend Erica Brown. And I decided to take this question as well in a journalistic sense, but in a very personally journalistic sense, to people who were faith leaders around the country. I wanted to go to people who were recognizable both to me and to other people. You know, yes, I talked to my rabbi, Danny Zemel, at Temple Micah. You know, my teacher, Erica Brown, Rachel Cowan in New York. These are more progressive Jewish figures, but some Orthodox. I went to Tim Keller, who's the evangelical preacher in New York at Redeemer Church. I went to Joel Osteen, not knowing what I'd find exactly, thinking, you know, I was actually a little worried when I went to Joel Osteen that he might spin me a little bit and say, look, you know, you know, the question of how's your faith and how do you deepen your faith, you know, you just have to accept Christ as your Lord and Savior and everything will be okay. And I really did think, okay, you know, if I don't know, that would just be, to me, more of a spin-like answer. But that's not what I got from him. As a matter of fact, I remember going to the service at Lakewood in Houston and had this wonderful experience there because it's just an incredibly spiritual and enlightening place. And I wrote to Beth. I said, oh, gosh, this is great. I'm going to talk to Pastor Joel. His service was fantastic. And she says, is Jesus your guy yet? And I actually showed him that text, and he just laughed. But, you know, he didn't say what I thought he might say. What he said to me was, you know what, I just encourage you to have a heart for God, just to let God in a little bit more and kind of see what happens. And that's what he encouraged me to do. And I thought about that. What does that mean to have a heart for God? It means to me having a certain openness, an openness to receive, an openness to understand God however we understand God in our lives, he, she, it, whatever that force, that mysterious force is, or maybe it is less mysterious, maybe it's much more intimate as being Christ, and having a more direct relationship. But the idea of having a heart for God, trying to live in relation to God, is something that became very powerful to me, because there, God as inspiration, God as perhaps revealing a way, showing me how to live, something to aspire to, even though I fail so often. So that journey of discovery to religious leaders, to ancient texts, to more contemporary spiritual reading, really started to fill out this question of what it is that I believe. And then there was another question that was asked of me by my teacher. We used to go to Starbucks in Bethesda. And she said, and this was early on at Meet the Press, she said, David, now she was, this is a woman, Erica, who when she first met me did not know who I was, which was, you know, which was fine. She wasn't really plugged into the culture. But she was always kind of amazed at how pressure-filled TV was and just all the trappings of it. She said, you know, David, who would you be if you lost all of this? And I said, you know, first of all, don't go asking questions. Second of all, I said, I don't know. I said, it's not really something that I think about. I've been on television since I was 18, working in television news. It's a huge part of my identity. It's just, things have gone incredibly well. I mean, I just assume it'll always go like this. I can't imagine it not going like this. I mean, it's all I've ever known. I mean, you talk about lack of perspective. You know, I started at NBC when I was 25 and first started to work for Wendy when I was 28, you know, and all of a sudden was covering the White House at 30 and, you know, on and on it went. So I only knew kind of one speed. And so I said, you know, I don't know. It's a big part of my identity. I really don't know. Well, the question was actually quite, you know, useful. So, you know, because when things were not going well at NBC, you know, it was tough. You know, those of us who are in the news business are pretty thin-skinned people, and we don't like done to us what we do to other people. And so, as I remember one time, this is this intersection of what I was trying to achieve, you know, through faith in this path. And the Washington Post, you've heard of that, wrote a really tough piece about me, which was essentially, you know, what went wrong at Meet the Press. This is while I was still there, including some bad information that was in there. And, you know, it was tough. And so, you know, I was thinking, I knew that we were having various struggles at the show, but there was a sense of, wow, now everybody knows. Like, we didn't have to tell everybody, did we? Can't we just deal with it on our own? And so I remember kind of fighting back. I was fighting kind of externally and internally. And the internal piece was to say to my bosses, look, this is Washington. There's blood in the water now. I'm vulnerable. You have to shore me up. This is politics in a way. I'm bleeding here. And so I'm having that fight. And I'm talking to somebody else. And I said, you know, I'm bloodied and beaten, but I'm still standing and I'll survive this and on and on. And I asked Erica to come over and study. And she said, David, you know, you're using all this war imagery. She said, but you're not talking about love at all. And I said, really? I said, let me tell you why. Do you know what's happening here? And she said, right, but these are the moments. These are the moments that really test you and ask, who is it that you want to be? If you can answer it and meet the test now, then you're really on to something. Then all of a sudden, this internal life that you're trying to grow and nurture and mature can actually be there for you when it matters. And we studied something from Proverbs 4, verse 6, which is, establish the way of your feet and all your ways will be true. And the idea was if you begin a maze at ground level and you can't see the way out through the maze, imagine going to the balcony level and then looking down and seeing your way through the maze. That's a sense of having a path of who you want to be and setting that course and really sticking to it and being that person. That was her lesson for that day. And so it's something I thought about when I left, and I thought, you know, there are leaks, you know, coming from inside NBC and, you know, nasty things that are being said, and it's very unpleasant and it's embarrassing. But who do I want to be in this moment, and how do I model this for my children? And so we went to go pick up the kids from summer camp when NBC leaked, you know, we were having conversations about me leaving, and then they leaked that it was happening. And we were driving. So we picked them up from camp, and the next day we're driving to the airport in New Hampshire. And Matt Lauer calls me, and Matt and I were not ever that close, but it was a very gracious phone call, and it was very nice. And I got off the phone, and my oldest son said to me, he said, Daddy, you know, who was that? I said, well, that was Matt Lauer. And he said, well, why is he calling you? And I said, well, honey, I said, because, you know, I'm no longer going to be on Meet the Press. And I explained a little bit of the situation. Very thoughtful, my son Max. And he just paused and he said, Daddy, do we have to sell the house? I wanted to say, do you have any idea what your mother does for a living? No. I said, no, honey, we're very smart. I said, for a lot of people in this situation, it would be very stressful. That is not our issue. We're very lucky. It's not a problem. And then my daughter said, Daddy, did you get fired? And I'm thinking the whole time, you know, how do you tell your kids that you lost your job? And I said, well, I said, sweetheart, no, not exactly. I said, you know, because the truth was I was not fired. I felt like I was getting fired and I thought I would have been fired. But I actually forced the issue, which led to what happened. So I said, no, I don't want you to think I did something wrong because I didn't. I said, but let me make it very clear. They wanted someone else to do the job. I said, you guys have seen one aspect of my life in television, which is people want my autograph or my picture. They tell me for no good reason that they love me. There's another side, and that's that when things happen, it's public. They may, you know, say things about you in the papers, you know, on television, and so forth. You know, so that's the other side of it. And then my son, Jed, he said, Daddy, did they make fun of you? And I said, yes, they did. I said, but, I, you know, I can handle it. But my point in all that was I was doing a lot for my kids to try to model a certain behavior, to try to be classy, to try to be gracious. And I thought throughout that my faith really held me through that. So I thought I had an answer to Erica's question that was really affirmative. But the honest truth is that the identity piece was huge, and it was a real blow. You know, the question of who are you was one that I asked and I struggled with after leaving NBC. Leaving a job like that with that perch really did create a bit of a crisis inside of me and, you know, led me to ask, well, if I'm not that, do I still matter? Do I still have standing? Do people want to talk to me? And it was a difficult path. And so in a way, the deeper religious education began there, because in those moments, that's where faith can teach. And for me, it was a true lesson in humility, the idea that things did not work out as I had planned, that I had weaknesses that I had to deal with, the indifference that was I was met with when I left inside the community, inside NBC, was hurtful. And I had to think about, well, why is that? You know, and really internalize that and think about, well, what could I have done to have treated people in such a way that when something bad happened to me, they reached out to me? And I reflected on that. And I think, again, my faith helped to guide me in that sense. And in the process, I became truly grounded in faith with a sense of deeper identity than what I do for a living, and a sense of vulnerability and humility that helps me to understand that I have weaknesses, that I have flaws, that I've made mistakes, and that things don't always work out as planned. But there's a little bit more humanity in myself and in others that I've discovered along the way, and it's been deeply meaningful to me. A couple of other quick stories before we have a dialogue about this. So my father was uncomfortable with the book. He was uncomfortable because I write about my mother's alcoholism and I write about his response and his sense of denial about her drinking and the fact that he really frightened me as a little boy, and we had a difficult relationship when I was young. But then even as an adult, we fought because I was even estranged from him at various times. Because it was, you know, because of that fear and not kind of working through that. And we just had a tough relationship. And yet, he was a big influence on who I became in my career, paid such close attention, was very proud of me, and we worked hand in glove, especially when I was young, in charting my course, and he was really responsible for cultivating my ambition. But he was uncomfortable with the book, and that was so difficult. I'm here, I'm reading about my alcoholic mother getting arrested and all the rest, and she was fine. But it's my mother it's my father who had more of a difficult time. Well, my father's health started to decline, and he became increasingly enthralled with the religious search because he just didn't understand it, didn't understand where it came from, but was awed by it in a way. Yeah, I mean, he was proud of me, but he was really enthralled by it. He was taken with it. And it became this source of bonding between us. As he became sicker and more vulnerable and more scared, I would reach out to him. I would talk to him about, you know, opening his heart and allowing, at least allowing himself the opportunity to think about God's presence, to not being alone. I would read to him from Psalms about God being present at all times, and allowing him to try to get over some of the regrets he had and to just allow himself to accept a lot of the love around him. And I flew down there one day, and he came home from the hospital. He had a very difficult night at home, and I remember leaving. This was on a Wednesday morning, and I said, Dad, you know, I'm going to go now, and I said, I hope to see you again. I said, but if you die before I return, I want you to know that that's okay. My heart is full. There's nothing left unsaid between us, and I'm just so happy that you're my father, and I feel so lucky. And I took his hand and I prayed a beautiful poem in the Jewish liturgy, Adon Olam. Into your hand my soul I place, when I awake and when I sleep. God is with me, I shall not fear. Body and soul from harm will he keep. And he just smiled and said, that's beautiful. And we left. I left. And he died the next day. And I can only tell you that, you know, for me, faith, for me, seeking to live with an understanding and a feeling of God's presence has transformed my life. It adds to my life. And that was an example of a truly beautiful parting. You know, that was an elevated time that went beyond, you know, mere words. And it's one of the great gifts, you know, that I've experienced on this path. So I'll leave you with one thing, which is before we, I was looking through this today and I thought, well, just to continue the God talk business. This is something that really kind of impacts me that I as I kind of summed up, you know, I do a chapter about surrender. You know, a lot of people ask me, well, do you, is being a person of faith, do you surrender, you know, your rational beliefs? And I say no, you know, I mean, especially as a Jew, you know, the place of the rational plays a big role. There's lots of things I don't understand about God, and I just am wrestling with that, and I don't have a handle or any kind of mastery on it. But at the same time, the idea of some level of surrender, the idea of experiencing grace, the idea of experiencing God's presence from the mundane encounters we have at work or with family or meeting a friend for lunch is something that I find powerful. And so I write this: over time, I have found myself becoming more comfortable with surrendering to God. What was hard for me at first has become easier. It feels more natural to me now to let him in, to see God as someone guiding me. I feel as though God knows my mind and loves me enough to urge me to do better. I hear his wisdom in the voice that I hear first thing in the morning, the truth voice, before the other thoughts filter in, before I start to rationalize. At this stage of my life, I know that God has a daily spiritual ask of me, whether it is giving of myself, avoiding hurtful speech, or controlling anger. Does that mean that God is in control of my life? It is hard for me to get to the place where I believe that God is directing the world for me. I just feel like I bear too much responsibility for what happens to me. Unfortunately, I may hear, but I don't always listen, which puts me on the path of the stumblers in life who are always trying to find the way back. The important thing, as Pastor Joel, since we're on first name terms now, Pastor Joel Osteen reminds his congregation, is to put God in first place. I believe that I am responsible for what I do in the world. If I hurt others, I will suffer for that. But simply believing in God's presence itself is a surrender of sorts. It requires me not to let go. Rather than wondering whether God is controlling me, I try to think of God as a presence to guide me. I turn my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? Writes the psalmist. My help comes from the Lord. My willingness to surrender more of my life to God is part of a larger desire to develop a more spiritual Jewish identity and practice. One snowy Sunday morning in early 2015, I took my 9-year-old twins to Jewish Sunday school at Temple Micah in Washington. One of the rabbis asked parents and kids to break off into small groups and come up with an answer to the question, "What role does God play in your life?" I wrote that God inspires me to do better, to be better. The exercise made me realize that now I have studied him. God is no longer a question for me. Mysterious, sure, but not a question. I know God. He is many things in the Bible. He is our creator. He destroys, he redeems, he teaches, and he loves. Rabbi Larry Hoffman says the question shouldn't be whether we believe in God. Does anyone ask you whether you believe in love? He says. Like many people, I am lucky enough to know love. I don't have to try to convince myself of its existence. And now I am lucky enough to be able to say the same about God.
Thank you.
So anyway, a bit of an introduction, so I turn it over to you for any questions. Oh, we have microphones and everything. Okay.
Recording.
Yes, go ahead.
So you have a certain different sense of identity now that goes beyond your professional career.
Yeah.
And what is your aspiration now with this new identity?
Well, you know, for a time, I was just kind of open to that question. And I didn't really know. You know, I certainly spent time after leaving NBC thinking I didn't want to return to that, you know, I guess to return to journalism in that way. I just needed to decompress a little bit and think about it, pour myself into the book, think about what lessons I could draw from it. I'm not going to become a rabbi. And the truth is, I miss it. I'm ready to get back to work. And I'm talking to a lot of people about getting back to work. I miss the news. I miss covering the news. I miss politics and world affairs. I miss the experiences that I've had. So I want to get back to it. But I want to be different. I don't want to have gone through this and this, the spiritual search, the humbling experience of, you know, losing my job at NBC without being different, without changing. And I've tried to really spend some time thinking about that. I'm very interested in faith as even an area of journalism for me. But yeah, I mean, I'd like to get back to it with a greater sense of perspective and humility. And with the with now the idea to really understand, you know, what it's like to have not lost it all, because I didn't lose it all, but to lose something that was important. I think that can only make me better. So, yeah, I'm ready to get back.
First of all, David, I want to thank you for writing this book.
Thank you.
And sharing a journey with us. It's a book that I recommend to a lot of people.
Thank you.
And since you were the only guest here, you're dealing with a pretty big round table right now.
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to say that having read the book, it makes me feel stronger, like you said, and proud.
Thank you.
And thank you again for writing this book.
Thank you. Very kind. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. This is a slightly embarrassing question, but I'm going to ask. I don't know if I'll read your book, and I could probably learn something there. And I certainly am not going to find an Erica Brown, because I'm not motivated enough to get that. I'm one of the Jews you talked about. I grew up with religion, actually,
right.
But don't have it. But I wish I had it. I mean, my concept is that, well, if I believed in God in a stronger way, I would never have to worry, because I'd say, oh, God will take care of me. He'll take care of everything. So to the best of your ability, could you suggest a shortcut?
Yes, here's a shortcut. You don't have to read my book. All you have to do is buy my book. You know, here's the thing. First of all, I challenge the premise in this way, which is the leap is not to the idea of like, oh, great, I have faith, so now I don't have to worry. You know, I'm just kick back and cruise. First of all, I mean, any kind of prayer or a commitment to God requires a great deal of work and concentration, and it's a relationship you have to develop over time. I also don't happen to believe that, again, as I was saying, that we are, you know, I don't know. I have no idea, but I don't necessarily believe that God is predetermining our path. What I believe in is God's presence and cultivating God's presence, so that there's good things that happen, there's bad things that happen, there's joy in the world, there's pain in the world, there's elation and there's disappointment, but God is there, that we are not alone. And all I can tell you is that what I have come to experience, whether it's my son's bar mitzvah, whether it was my beautiful parting with my father, whether it is the connection I have with my children when they light the Shabbat candles, there are moments of transcendence that bring me to tears that I can only explain through the presence of something greater than myself. And it's a wonderful to be open to that experience and to, you know, to experience that joy. And so, in a way, I think the question of faith is a question of greater personal awareness. And simply opening your heart to some experience. Maybe it's a greater sense of community at a synagogue if you belong. Maybe it's reading some of the Psalms, you know, and seeing if something moves you. You know, it's exposing yourself in some way to a piece of text or a religious lesson that might just land on your ears or your heart in a way that moves you. My friend Erica, in her book, she has a meditation today about prayer, and she's talking about Gandhi, and Gandhi is saying that prayer is not an act of request. It's not a request for something. It's an admission. It's an admission that your soul makes of a certain weakness and a certain yearning. So if we can kind of declutter our mind a little bit and just say, hey, how do I open up my heart to be, you know what I think is an act of faith? We all know people, right, who say, hey, how you doing? You know, how's it going? How are you? Oh, I'm great. How are you doing? And then we encounter that person who says, how are you? And you stop and you look, and they look right through you. I think that's just a certain kind of awareness, you know, to be a little bit more mindful. Mm-hmm. To me, I think God is in all those moments. That's for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
I think you're great.
Thank you.
I'm moved by the grounding and the self-responsibility and the openness you're bringing. And I'm a professional. I teach religion and minister and things like that. And I want to ask one question in two forms. I'm interested in your emphasis on openness, because that's open of heart, openness to listening, mm-hmm. openness to meaning. And yet, one of the things we teach in the world of religion is that the very word religion is about that which binds us, the ligaments of our lives. So I'm curious about what you feel bound to. But the other question that's actually also really burning is, so you've given us this book now, and you're in a position to speak really well with it. What are you hoping it will accomplish in this crazy, fucked up world of Washington politics? And so I'm holding those two questions in my mind together and asking you, is there something you hope in this book will help bind us, maybe, or is openness enough?
Well, I mean, I'm not so arrogant to believe that I can or should be that ambitious. I guess
please be
that ambitious. I mean, I think what my hope is I like to say the questions that I posed: how's your faith, and how could your faith be better? You know, my answers, the way I've tried to answer these questions, are no better than your answers. I just encourage people to sit with the question and to kind of lean into the question and do this kind of inventory, this self-reckoning, a moral inventory, whatever you want to call it, is just a kind of a check-in to say, well, you know, who am I and where am I? You know, when God asks Adam and Eve, you know, where are you? And again, a very piercing question. So where are you? Where are we all? And are we where we want to be? And so in that way, I think I guess I come back to openness because, in part, I think about, you know, what are the things that I have to work on? You know, controlling my temper, trying to be more compassionate, trying to be more humble, trying to have more perspective, something that I've lacked for a long time, trying to quiet, you know, myself. You know, things that don't come easy, but that I think are important, and I think just kind of opening your eyes and opening your heart at the same time. You know, Cardinal Dolan said to me this around this openness point. He said, you know, there's a danger in this, what you're doing, which is that it's too much of a project. You know, you're tackling this thing. You want to ask these tough questions. You want to get your arms around it. You want to hold it. You want to be able to really get some mastery over it. And he said, you have to let go of all that. He said, this is truly, he said, faith is at its core an act of love. It is a dare. And he talked about the Gospel of Luke and Jesus saying to his disciples that they should cast deep after a day when they've been fishing and caught nothing. And they decide, sure, okay, we'll do it again, and their baskets fill up. The point is that there is a still small voice inside of us. You know, if you understand that as the voice of God or something else, the point is there's powerful voices in the whispers. And if we open ourselves up, we can hear the voice to try to be better than we are now. And I think there's room for that as we think about, you know, journalism and politics and our political discourse. And by the way, let's forget politicians and how they talk to each other. How about the way we talk to ourselves? How do we encounter people in this town with whom we disagree politically? Is there room for that person to believe what they believe? Do we think it's legitimate? Or do we think we're in this struggle that is only fortified by radio and the internet and cable to win this argument at all costs, that we're in this huge knockdown, drag-out fight to win the argument? Maybe we can just respect each other's views and have a sense that everybody's trying to do their very best. Your initial question had to do with kind of the ligament of religion, an interesting metaphor. You know, for me, it's very important to me that I'm grounded in Jewish faith. You know, people have said, well, you know, have you thought about converting and all? I say, yeah, I do. I mean, you know, I don't know what the ultimate answer is, but I feel a real sense of identity, of Jewish identity. And I try to keep myself grounded religiously in a Jewish construct. I am a Reformed Jew. I pick and choose. The Orthodox would not, you know, approve of what I do. But it's who I am. It's the choices I've made, and it works for me. But it doesn't mean that I don't recognize what the Jewish law is and what the responsibilities are, and I do my very best. But I believe in being rooted in that place and then reaching out to other faiths and other language that I think helps me to experience grace and to try to grow. That's how I approach it.
Yeah.
Yes?
Excuse me. Do you find yourself sometimes being mad at God? After all, it's okay, but Jewish religion, it's okay to fight God, because
right.
After the name Israel means to fight God. So you do it sometimes yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I have not. No, I don't find myself fighting God as much. I mean, I may find myself doubting God or doubting myself or doubting the relationship, but I don't in a profoundly Jewish sense. And I think some of that is generational. I'm 45. You know, I didn't grow up with the Holocaust generation. I certainly understand, you know, why so many Jews moved away from God, either real belief in God or even speaking about God, which is not a very Jewish thing to do. A lot of Jews don't like to talk about God. And there's reasons for that. So, no, I don't find myself arguing as much. I try to get to a different place of acceptance and just, you know, experiencing God's presence and trying to understand that that again, there can be a lot of pain in the world, but there can also be joy. And that just because there's so much pain doesn't mean that I want to give up on the joyful parts. That there's something very tangible about life in that way. Yeah.
You've met and talked with a lot of people in politics and public life. Can you think of one or two that have impressed you as being the most interesting, fascinating? And is there anyone you can think of who impressed you as having this sort of spiritual self-awareness that you've been talking about?
You know, I think it's hard. I mean, the spiritual self-awareness, I go to Bush, and that's a controversial statement because of how people viewed him, and they viewed a sense of religious certainty as fueling a lot of the choices that he made, which I don't agree with. I believe that I asked him about this once when we were in Israel, and he said, you know, a lot of people ask me or are concerned about my faith because they think it leads me to make irrational decisions. He said, for me, it's really a personal journey, a kind of a port in the storm. In other words, he did view faith as personal transformation, and that is how I tend to view it. So for me, there was a humility and a self-awareness that came in his own faith. What I find disappointing about our discussion of faith in public life is that it inevitably becomes so divisive. Is that if you are, you know, a person of faith, then we get sidetracked. We're talking about abortion. We're talking about gay marriage and what the church says you can believe and not believe, or what as a Jew you can believe or not believe, or how you treat women and all the rest. That's just not my thing. I mean, I like to explore the extent to which religious life in an individual has, for a politician, has formed their sense of the common good, about service to other people, about how they approach other people, and where their inner life, you know, plays a role. I asked Tony Blair about this, and he said, you know, it's not like, you know, you huddle in the corner and ask God whether you should raise the minimum wage. You know, you seek God's presence for you know, for strength of your convictions and for courage and for comfort. And because you're in an incredibly stressful situation where so many people are relying upon you and lives can really be moved. So that you know, in that speech, in that way, I've always been interested in politicians who are willing to think in your presence. And there's a lot of them who don't, who are not willing to do that. And there's, you know, there's some of the current ones who actually do. Marco Rubio, I have experienced when he was on Meet the Press, he would, you know, he's a pretty program politician with a lot of talking points for sure, like the rest. Yet he was willing to have a real dialogue with you. Chris Christie, I found to be the same way. Obviously, Bill Clinton was kind of famous for being able to think in your presence and to do battle with you or to just kind of take on what you were saying. But I think there is less and less willingness to be sort of vulnerable that way. And I don't mean emotionally vulnerable, but really kind of intellectually vulnerable, certainly in the course of interviews that you may see on a Sunday morning program or more generally. And yet we live in an age where there's so much distrust of politicians and of government and of media and of corporations. And what is the great quest about? It's for authenticity. You know, why is there so much reality television that's doing so well? You know, people want to look behind the curtain a little bit and they want to see people a little bit more authentic. And so I think that's certainly celebrated. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Hi, that actually kind of dovetails with the question I was going to ask. You talk a lot about faith being about personal transformation and your personal journey. My question is about the community of faith. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about experiencing these moments with your family. But for a lot of people, you know, experiencing God is through the community of faith that they participate in.
Yeah.
For me, growing up as a pastor's daughter in an evangelical background, you get, you know, a much wider perspective on that. But what has soured me on faith is that community and the hypocrisy that you often see in it. So what advice or what sort of insight have you gleaned from, you know, writing this book and talking to the people that you've talked to about finding your place as you're doing this personal transformation, your own personal journey in whatever religion you're a part of? How do you reconcile that with other members of that community of faith with whom you vehemently disagree?
I don't. I mean, you know, part of it is to just struggle and to be comfortable with not having all of these answers. You know, for me, I was kind of pursuing my faith a little bit too individually. Like, this was my personal project, and I could go see all these, you know, big religious leaders, and I could kind of just do this on my own. And I was always encouraged, no, you should really seek community, whether it was a study group that I had at a certain point, or really feeling more deeply rooted in my community at Temple Micah, which I really do. Without, I think, holding it up to an impossible standard. I mean, if what you're getting at, I mean, there's hypocrisy, there's duplicity, there's just philosophical and ideological disagreements. I really try to keep these things around the affairs of the heart. And, you know, I'm not one, I don't particularly care for sermonizing that has to do with politics. You know, in this town, we just can get that in so many other ways. I remember walking into synagogue and some guy says, "Well, what do you think about Brian Williams?" And I said, "You know, I didn't come here to have that discussion." And so that is how I feel about it. I think there's a, you know, I think we have to recognize that there is so much failure in this pursuit. The ones who are doing it fail. We all fail. I fail all the time. I fail in my prayer practice. I fail to be the person that I think God expects me to be. I fail all the time. But the only thing I'm comforted by is that I think I have a greater awareness that I have of my own weaknesses and my own vulnerabilities. And I've gained some real humility through that. And so maybe that humility can extend as a kind of gift that we give other people, which is everybody's fighting their own battle. And if we can hold that, we might really get somewhere. It would allow us to be a little bit more patient with people, even the leaders who presume to tell us, you know, how to live and how to guide our lives. We see them as failed human beings too. That to me is the path. David Brooks has this wonderful line in The Road to Character, which is, you know, true humility is understanding you're always an underdog in that struggle against your own weakness. And I think that really teaches something. So thank you for that. Yeah.
Yes, you talked about starting out looking at this as a project, and I'd be very interested when you started out, the types of questions you had on your project list, and to the extent that the answers, if all these people you interviewed, you know, what was the one commonality or the biggest difference between some of them in terms of the answer to the questions?
Well, I think there was a lot of commonality around a lot of the language I use, which is about kind of having a heart for God, being open to the experience, looking at understanding faith as fundamentally love, love for God, God's love for us, and our love for each other. You know, I just think from love can come greater awareness and humility and openness and compassion. And that's just a really good place to have it all. What it doesn't get to is a greater place of certainty. You know, I have a real problem with certainty and faith. There's that bumper sticker I heard about, which is, I don't know and you don't know either. And, you know, I've spent time, I've forced myself. Recently, I read The End of Faith by Sam Harris, which is a great book. He's one of the big atheists. And, you know, I was really challenged by that. And I just did an hour and a half interview with him for a podcast, which will be debuting later this month. And fascinating, really provocative. So I think the questions for me initially were about, well, where do I kind of fit into Jewish life? What does it mean to be Jewish? And so there's a lot of identity caught up in that. Then it was exploring Jewish ritual and what do I get out of that? Ultimately, it was about a sense of greater meaning. How do I experience meaning in life, a sense of purpose? How do I experience something larger? How do I experience transcendence? You know, and in a way, we can talk like that and think that we're talking about, you know, it can sound like very, you know, this hooey out there, you know, that I've kind of departed the building. But in fact, it's about trying to experience the divine, and there's so many ways to experience. And I wanted to work harder to experience that through prayer, through relationship, through study, through self-examination. You know, a lot of people don't know. I mean, we have the example of Jesus Christ, certainly, and in his teachings. But, you know, medieval Jewish scholars were obsessed with these questions of character refinement and self-improvement. I mean, it's like reading Tony Robbins. I mean, it's, you know, it's how to deal with anger, how to be more humble, how to, you know, live a kind of cleaner, better life. So these were the questions that I was posing, you know, early on. Yeah.
Hi. I had so many questions, I can't even begin to pull them together. But one is, do you ever think about what it was like if you had not started the work with Erica Brown before this debacle with NBC? And related to that is, I'm curious because I've been going through my own search and belong to a synagogue, but, you know, like, I question whether the rabbi would really ever be that helpful to me, and I'm actually doing synagogue shopping right now, and, you know, I'm looking, and I just wondered if you mentioned early or in the introduction that, you know, there was, you had gone and searched and talked with lots of different people, so I'm curious about that with regard to the, you know, your own rabbi, yet you had Miss Brown and
right. Well, look, I mean, I think the work for me was really important, and it took different. There were different layers to it, but I think it's been really important to have in my life. I mean, I just think, you know, it has held me and strengthened me and made me a different person. I mean, you know, the whole of my experience, you know, to be a, you know, young professional in this business, you know, when Wendy first got to know me, you know, I mean, you know, I was just different. I mean, I didn't have the perspective that I have now. I was younger. I was very ambitious, ruthlessly ambitious. You know, that served me very well in some respects. You know, I succeeded quite well. But it came with certain costs, you know. It really did. And I didn't have the perspective to see all of that until later. And the grounding of faith is what I think helps me to sort of to cushion that fall, to help me see, to appreciate, I don't think I have it, my teacher Erica wrote me this wonderful note, and it is, you know, understanding the descent as leading to the ascent, you know, that we have to understand a fall that brings us up to a higher place. And so in that way, it's been really meaningful. I think you're exactly right. I mean, with regard to shopping for any kind of community of worship, it's about having a relationship. And, you know, we want a relationship with clergy that's different. You know, we want them to be friends, but they're different. We want them to help us on a path to holiness. And I think you have a right to seek that out and to lovingly demand that of your institution, which is both the people who are showing up that you feel fellowship with, but also your clergy that has to be have to be giving enough to speak to, you know, to really speak to your heart and not just your head, which in a lot of cases can be difficult in synagogue life.
David, thanks. We have time for one more question.
Okay.
So thank you for your book, and thank you for your years of journalism.
Thank you.
I enjoyed both. As I get older, I get more cynical about our future. Mm-hmm. Could you speculate on anything that makes you hopeful politically about the future?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I think we're in a difficult period. We're in a polarized period. I think what makes me hopeful is ultimately studying history to realize that we've been here before. We have experienced demagogues in our politics before. We have experienced times of even worse kind of social upheaval than even we're experiencing now. And we have a way of persevering and coming together and bonding together as a country and as a people. And I really do believe in our ability to do that. And I think we have, you know, there's also great hope in all of us as individuals. You know, the kinds of demands that we can place on the media we consume or the kind of politicians we get. You know, we do have a real say in our tastes, in what we consume and what we listen to and what we read and who we vote for. We still have that kind of power. So, you know, I think we're in a difficult, pretty cynical time. But I think that there's a lot of good in the world and there's a lot of potential, and we're a terrific country, and we keep innovating and we keep growing. And, you know, I think about, you know, we went to the National Archives. I took my kids to the National Archives over break because that was really what they wanted to do. after I bribed them by taking them to paintball. And so I took my son Max, he's up at a boarding school in New Hampshire, a junior boarding school, and that's been hard. He's been away, but he's taking history and he was learning about the Bill of Rights. And I was asking him some questions about the Bill of Rights and he couldn't answer. So I said, "We're going to the archives." And I bought him a copy of the Bill of Rights. And I said, "Okay, son, before you go back to school, I want to tell you a couple of things. First of all, I really want you to floss because your dentist really wants you to floss. Second of all, I said, I'm going to read you the Bill of Rights." And I said, "These are important. I said, these are your individual rights. And, you know, there were figures in our early republic who fought for these rights so that you as an individual would have these protections. This is what it means to be an American." And it just, you know, it's always had a big effect on me. And I'm not certain that it really, you know, floored him. But it's just a reminder that, you know, we're a great country and we have lots of flaws. And but, you know, things will always improve, and we'll be responsible for that. So have hope. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. So I'm quite honored and humbled that you would show up in such a great number at my favorite bookstore, and I'm here to sign some books.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.